A piano contains over 10,000 moving parts, each calibrated to perfection, waiting for human touch to bring them to life. When Andrew McMahon's mother unwrapped her birthday gift, a gleaming black piano with keys like a checkerboard matching his incomplete childhood smile, neither could have predicted this instrument would become his lifeline through addiction, cancer, and ultimately, redemption. The piano arrived in their Chicago North Shore home as a symbol of suburban success, but it would evolve into something far more profound, a witness to tragedy, a vessel for grief, and eventually a bridge back to life itself. While his mother's clicking fake nails danced across classical compositions, young Andrew hid in hallway corners, mesmerized by her musical magic, unknowingly preparing for the day when necessity would bind him to those keys forever. Summer 1991 brought two seismic shifts, a move from Illinois to a shadowy Tudor home in California, and Andrew's first encounter with mortality. His uncle Stuart, the family's buoyant raft, died at 38 from cancer. For a boy about to turn 9, death's machinery was utterly foreign. He slipped a poem into Stuart's coffin lining, believing his uncle might read it in whatever came next. The family moved into their strange new house the very night Stuart was buried, a castle-like structure sitting 50 feet below street level, where coyotes howled through Andrew's basement bedroom window. For a month, he cried himself to sleep, praying for Stuart's return. Then, September arrived with unexpected grace. Sitting before the piano with dangling legs, Andrew formed his first chord. Three simple notes a friend had shown him could create 6 possible combinations. As he stumbled through this progression, something miraculous happened. His voice joined in, completing their circuit. Sunlight poured gold across the trees outside as time both stopped and raced forward. The piano became his sanctuary, music his salvation, a spiritual fire they would tend together on the very best days when songs were born. The McMahon family kept moving, California to Ohio to California again, each relocation another upheaval in Andrew's developing identity. In Bexley, Ohio, tired of being the new kid, Andrew lashed out until his teacher, Mrs. Davis, extended compassion that broke his defenses. Music became his social currency. When she encouraged him to perform for classmates, it led to friendships and playground protection. At a school assembly, he discovered performance's transformative power, losing himself as children stood cheering on chairs. Meanwhile, his father was eroding, growing volatile and distant. By spring 1994, the ground shifted. The phone rang from a correctional facility, his father arrested for using counterfeit prescriptions. The house erupted, tears, frantic calls, his grandfather's anger triggering Andrew's own rage. Seeking escape, Andrew auditions for an arts boarding school in Idlewild, performing classical pieces poorly but pouring his soul into an original song about Chicago. For theater, he channeled buried pain into a monologue that left faculty speechless. His acceptance letter arrived with a scholarship, but his newly sober father made canceling this dream his first act of parenting. Andrew argued viciously, but realized his mother would forgive any harm. He reluctantly accepted their move to Dana Point, pulling away emotionally, learning early that love and disappointment often arrive hand in hand. By late 1996, life bloomed. Andrew found friendship with boys who spent Saturday nights creating fake detours in affluent neighborhoods, joyrides symbolizing pure youth. Summer 1997 brought weightless freedom, school musicals, beach nights, and his first marijuana high when moonlit shadows suddenly became profound. This awakening, seeking transcendence in various forms, would become a recurring theme. At 16, Andrew abandoned the family piano for a garage keyboard, writing songs about love, car crashes, and kissing drunk girls. His band started in churches before Gary, the denim-clad coach house owner, took a chance on them. After graduation, Gary paid for their album. When crowds grew, drive-through records came calling. Being 19 and cut loose was miraculous. Floor sleeping, broke, binge drinking, something corporate recorded down the hall from Tom Petty in studios once used by the Beach Boys. But they were the most unpunk thing at punk shows. Andrew faced hecklers who threw bottles, shoes, rocks, spit, even a block of ice that hit his face in Texas. They didn't give up, bleeding for their songs until crowds turned. By 2004, Andrew transformed his bedroom into a creative sanctuary for Jack's mannequin, working through nights fueled by coffee and determination. At 4th Street Studio in Santa Monica, he and producer Jim Wirt built songs from scratch, dancing wildly between takes. May 27, 2005 shattered everything. After completing his album in New York, Andrew found himself racing toward Memorial Sloan Kettering Hospital. For nearly a week, he'd pushed through violent fevers, night sweats, and struggling breaths. The Tuesday morning diagnosis arrived like stones, acute lymphocytic leukemia. At UCLA Medical Center, Dr. Schiller became both lifeline and harbinger of necessary suffering. High-dose chemotherapy ravaged his body. Mouth sores made eating torture. Migraines clouded thoughts. Rashes spread across his skin. His mother and sister coordinated daylight vigils, while Kelly maintained quiet watches through afternoon and night. Dr. Schiller delivered unexpected news. Andrew's sister Kate was a perfect bone marrow match, a rare 25% occurrence. The stem cell transplant was scheduled for August 23rd, synchronistically the same day his album Everything in Transit would be released. The procedure appeared simple, but what followed was brutal. Weeks of savage rashes, skin peeling in sheets, mouth ulcers making eating excruciating, throat so inflamed he could barely swallow water. By October, Andrew returned home weighing just 114 pounds, skin constantly cracking, feet numbed by neuropathy. Medical wisdom suggested a year-long recovery, but Andrew rejected this timeline with characteristic defiance. He performed on his 100-day transplant anniversary, though he needed help climbing stairs to the stage. In December, seeing a future beyond survival for the first time, he proposed to Kelly. Despite projecting joy publicly, Andrew was drowning in private depression. The pressure to write a follow-up album became paralyzing, his creative confidence surging one day, completely abandoning him the next. Cancer had shattered his illusion of control, leading him to lash out at bandmates, his manager, and most frequently, Kelly. He wore gratitude as a mask while concealing wounds that refused to heal. By late 2007, Andrew embarked on a cross-country road trip seeking solitude. Driving alone through Texas's vast landscape, valleys, deserts, hill country beneath cloud mountain skies, he found what he'd been missing, the space between breaths, his lost sense of destiny, renewed faith in music, and his smallness within something greater. Alone on that road, he experienced forgiveness for himself and for the days that changed him, a private baptism that wouldn't last in the real world, but momentarily connected him with the peace he sought. After 18 months touring, reliving cancer in interviews by day, and proving his aliveness in bars by night, Andrew worried he was choosing his father's darkness. He and Kelly rented a house in Laguna Beach, where the ocean became his salvation. He played Jack's Mannequin's final show at the El Rey Theater on November 12, 2012. In August 2013, he rented a cabin in Topanga Canyon, spending weekdays behind a keyboard in isolation and weekends with Kelly, who was pregnant after an earlier miscarriage. As his canyon time ended, a presence visited his dreams, the little girl who would someday reach her mother's arms and his. Cecilia Kate was born the morning before Valentine's Day, 2014, with her mother's eyes, only darker. Holding her, Andrew finally found reason for his hard weather years. In spring 2015, they performed at Coachella. Cecilia and the Satellite, the song he'd written for his daughter, was about to become his first mainstream hit. Under a cloudless cobalt sky, Kelly danced with their daughter in the wings, wearing a yellow dress and wide-brimmed hat. His parents watched from the crowd. They never missed a show. The journey that began with a young boy and a piano had come full circle. Through addiction, cancer, and rebirth, music had been his constant companion. The three pianos marked different chapters of his evolution as musician and human being. He'd found his truth not in the roaring crowd, but waiting in the wings. His family, his home, his reason for surviving everything that tried to silence his song.